This episode is brought to you by Geek Aid. What's your geek? Been from Jotunheim to New York, all the way to Svartalheim, then Sokovia, Hawkeye's farm as well. Norse apocalypse is blowing Asgard to bits. Now I gotta punch Galadriel. Loki seditious and Judge Dredd there looks vicious, but the Hulk is a work friend of mine. And good thing for Valkyrie, they killed the Warriors Three, and we left Darcy and Jane behind. Keep Ragnarokin' me, baby. Keep Ragnarokin' me, baby. Keep Ragnarokin' me, rockin' me, rockin', baby, baby, baby. And I think I'll save the second verse for the outro. It contains minor spoilers. So, welcome one and all, comic fans out there in internet land. My name is Jordan Hazelwood. I'm across the sofa from my good friend and colleague, Mr. Brendan Michelli. And we welcome you to your ninth visit to the Nonstop Comic Shop, where we always have issues. Brendan, how does my Weird Al Yankovic impression find you today?
Oh, wow, I was not prepared for that.
I didn't want you to be, really.
You know, you could have told me at a time, I still don't think I would have been prepared.
I mean, what can I say? I'm one who always looks towards self-improvement, and you may remember our second episode, which was our Spider-Man Homecoming review. Mm-hmm. I said to myself, well, I kind of want to name this one Aunt May, I'm Coming Home, which is a play on Mama, I'm Coming Home, mm-hmm, by Ozzy Osbourne. And I said to myself, you know, I may be able to, like, actually sing that to, you know, bring the reference a little closer to home. So I of course, thought of this, like, 15 minutes before you arrived to record the episode, and I think it kind of showed.
Yeah.
I only did, like, half of one verse, and it was, the lyrics were way too obvious, and it also occurred to me, if I had thought about it for maybe an extra 10 minutes, I would have realized that Spider-Man Homecoming, the one Spider-Man movie of six that does not at all involve the Osborne family, I'm serenading with a song from Ozzy Osbourne.
Yeah, that...
You think I would have pointed that out, right?
Yeah. You think I would have caught that.
Mm-hmm. But, hey, you know, months ago when I knew we were locked in for a Thor Ragnarok review episode, I thought, like, hey, why don't I call it Keep Ragnarokin' Me, Baby, because, you know, I've always been bothered by Steve Miller's chorus that says, keep on rockin' me, like, mm-hmm, he couldn't think of another word to fill in the chorus, so yeah. Ragnarokin' works. But again, weeks ago, I said to myself, well, maybe I can sing that, so I double-checked the lyrics, and where it said, and a woman is a friend of mine, I said, well, obviously that's going to be, and the Hulk is a work friend of mine, then it all just kind of fell from, like, dominoes from there. So, hope you enjoyed that, folks. I guess we'll be moving on with the actual show now. Obviously, we'll be saving our review of the film for the second half. And I like to serve up an appetizer in which I review Gasp, a comic book, leading up to, you know, the comic book movie that obviously most of our fans really care about.
Yeah.
So, Thor comics. Thor. So,
that's kind of my opinion of Thor comics, mm-hmm, too.
So, most of my journeys began with one step towards my selection of large bookcases back there that have 165 or so Marvel Essentials. You know, those great phone books full of black and white reprints of wide swaths of comic book runs. So they say there are seven essential Thors, dating back to, of course, the very beginning with Journey into Mystery and the Stone Men of Saturn. And I said to myself, yeah, I got seven of these. And I have not yet touched 5, 6, or 7.
Wow.
I just bought them when they came out for completion's sake, but yeah, the 10 years or so that I think I've had, actually probably closer to 5 that I've had all seven, still haven't gone back to the last three. Huh. Wonder why that is. And then I look through essential number 4, like, oh yeah, they're really, really boring. A major theme I find of the new show is that I find myself talking about the 1970s era of Marvel a lot
I think I said something to the effect of Marvel was just kind of crap during the 70s, and there wasn't really a lot of great standouts. I mean, then I said, well, obviously the late 70s was owned by Chris Claremont's X-Men, and Tomb of Dracula from 72 to 77 or so was well worth reading. And then I remember, well, there was also The Defenders, the original run of The Defenders. Those are pretty enjoyable yarns. Let's not forget The Wild and Woolly World of Steve Gerber, who gave us Man-Thing and Howard the Duck.
Yeah.
Like, those were experiences, to say the least.
Those were uniquely 70s experiences.
So, I mean, I feel like I'm biting my tongue a bit, you know. I don't want to throw the whole decade under the bus, but I think more accurately, perhaps, I could say...
Their flagship titles were kind of crap.
Precisely. Yeah. Yes, I mean... Daredevil in the 70s was...
several episodes of the show. Daredevil of the 70s. Daredevil of the 70s was several episodes of the old show. That is all you need to say about Daredevil in the 70s.
And then, of course, all the major Avengers. I mean, hey, let's not forget that, you know, I also reviewed that landmark issue in which Captain America got to watch Nixon kill himself.
Yeah.
So that happened in the 70s. Yep. Wasn't that great? Hell, even Spider-Man. Like, I'm struggling to think of great 70s Spider-Man issues. Like, the Spider-Mobile, that was a laugh, right?
I think the Punisher got introduced in the 70s in Spider-Man.
Yes, but didn't really come into his own until the 80s.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it a great Spider-Man issue.
The first time, I mean, we'll probably be talking about the Punisher fairly soon for obvious trenchant reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't forget that when the Punisher was introduced, he was hired by an insane biochemist in a green dog outfit.
The Jackal.
To murder Spider-Man, because Punisher was willing to, you know, accept assassination contracts by dudes in green dog outfits.
Yeah,
that was originally
well,
his MO.
Well, you gotta forget that the caveat to that is the dude in the green dog outfit had to tell the Punisher that Spider-Man was evil first. And as evidence...
Is that hard to do?
You know, because as evidence, all he had to do was show him, you know, a copy of the Daily Bugle.
Yeah.
And he's like, wow, this Spider-Man is a real menace. I guess I better go shoot him.
When I think of 1970s Spider-Man issues, for some reason, I think of that one wrestler who read the Daily Bugle in which J. Jonah Jameson said that boxing was fake. And so the wrestler, I mind you, says, like, I must stand up for my comrades in arms in the similar squared circle. I'm going to put on this bear outfit. I'm going to go and tear J. Jonah Jameson in half at the Daily Bugle right now. I don't know why, but it's just, that just strikes me as the penultimate 1970s Spider-Man story.
Yeah,
maybe I just have a fondness for bears. I mean, I'm really fat and hairy, aren't I?
Wow, the 70s, yeah, just. Just the 70s. That's all that can really be said.
So anyway, Thor in the 70s. Well, Thor is kind of like Marvel Superman. He is the most obviously just outrageously overpowered entity in the main Marvel universe.
Despite Stan Lee's claims that Marvel doesn't do a Superman, here's a Superman. He's the literal god of thunder.
Mm-hmm. Well, he wears armor over his tights, so I guess that's enough of a point of separation. But it struck me rereading a lot of the early 70s Thor that Thor basically woke up and had to save the entire goddamn galaxy from a massive cataclysmic threat. Then he got to have lunch. Then he got to save the galaxy from another massive cataclysmic threat before dinner. Then he go to bed, and then he wake up and another massive pillars of heaven shaking. Apocalyptic threat would be waiting for him after breakfast, and just again, and to the point where the end of the universe becomes kind of rote and mundane. It is just, the shock value kind of loses its luster. So it felt like all the stories I could remember were really blurring together. The only real standout story of that era, I think, is the bit where Thor decides to rescue a kidnapped, like, rocket scientist from Latveria. Dr. Doom, kidnapped him to make missiles to, blow up the world, because Dr. Doom's got to do that, right?
Yeah, he's Dr. Doom, he's got a hobby.
So Thor strikes upon the ingenious idea to actually kind of exercise subterfuge and sneak into Latveria in his... swiftly to be forgotten civilian guise of the brilliant medical surgeon, Dr. Donald Blake. he was going to advertise that he has mastered the art of plastic surgery, which is not what he as a surgeon usually does. But hey, you know, as a comic book scientist, he specializes in the field of science. So he's like, I can repair any disfigured face in the world. So Dr. Doom's like, well, I gotta get that guy all up in my guts.
Yeah.
So he invites Dr. Donald Blake over, and all he had to do was just, like, pretend to operate on Dr. Doom, like, put him under or something, and then he can go spring that sinus. But no, Dr. Doom has to take his mask off for the early prognosis, and Thor, God of Thunder, man who has stared down monsters and gods and titans and world-swallowing serpents and Cthuloid horrors from beyond the veil, he found Dr. Doom so goddamn ugly that he basically vomited all over himself and got his ass thrown in the dungeon.
Yeah. I'm looking at that page right now. I mean, from a standpoint of, you know, how they set the panels up and how they pace it, it's actually really, really good and, you know, really suspenseful, but the end result is that, you know, a guy who has pretty much seen some shit takes one look at Dr. Doom's face and goes, nope, do not want.
But, I kind of wish I'd actually reviewed that. I mean, granted, unfortunately, it's not a very Thor-like story, which is probably what made it so unique in my mind. But no, that happens to be followed up with the ultimate 70s Thor story. A story arc so overblown, so bloated, tired, empty, vague, and boring, I actually remembered it almost perfectly. Like, this is the story that got me, I guess you could say, precluded me from reading the rest of, the Essential Thors. So, and I also have a fun tie-in later to the film that we're going to be reviewing. So, of course, that's a big boost. But here we are at Thor number 184. You know, the cover is some giant dude who's just, you know, about to wail on Thor. But there's a little caption on the side that is, I know, Brendan, is one of your absolute favoritest things in the world. It's not quite as overblown as some of them that we've already reviewed.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's a caption that says, and introducing in this issue, the sensational Silent One. You know, alas, it's not like the trumpeting fanfares of the Skywalker or Ma Mayhem. He's not saying he's the greatest comic book character of all time is born here. The one that shall sculpt the future of all comic books from here on out.
Yeah.
The one that all you kids are going to want to dress up as for Halloween this year. Now, they don't quite go that far, but they may as well. And so our story begins. Thor is just kind of, you know, schlepping down the Rainbow Bridge because Odin has summoned him. And I think he mentions that, I was just here the other day before the whole Doctor Doom fiasco because my evil brother Loki pickpocketed the Odin ring from the personage of the stately Allfather, Odin, and whoever wields the Odin ring is the unchallenged king of all of Asgard. And I'm like, it's just one of these things that makes me really, really grateful for democracy. For all its faults, you know? Just
it's like, democracy, hell, primogeniture would have taken care of that. I have the ring, I'm the king. No, I'm the king, I'm still alive, I'm still on the throne, and I say you get thrown in the dungeon and forgotten about forever, because that's how a feudal system works, you dipshit. Who holds the ring only matters maybe if there's a crisis of succession, but if the king is alive sitting on the throne, there's no crisis of succession.
Mm. Also, he admitted that he stole it. That's
why he admits he stole it.
If it's that easy, then why doesn't every Asgardian just dogpile his ass and grab the ring for themselves?
Yes.
Thor is saying to himself, Odin said that there's some sort of vague cosmic threat, you know, like every weekday, so I'm up here to find out what's going on. Susan, how are things shaking? So there's an entire page of him just wandering down Main Street Asgard and looking at various citizens who are staring unblinkingly up into the murky night sky, jaws agape, afraid of the coming evil that will imminently destroy them all. And none of them can actually put to words what exactly is going to happen. So for like six whole panels, Thor's like, so what's the evil like? It's undescribable, my lord. What do you think the evil's like? It will destroy us all, my lord. What do you think the evil's like, ma'am? Stan Lee hasn't thought of it yet. He asked us to stall you. That's what they may as well just say.
You're all staring up at the sky with terrified expressions, but I'm not going to look up at the sky and see what you're looking at. So, you know.
Oh yeah, that too.
Because I'm the hero of the comic, and the villain won't actually attack until I'm aware of his presence. So if I pretend he's not there, he's just going to be stuck in limbo, unable to swing a punch.
Mm-hmm. So eventually he makes it to the throne room, and he and Odin have a long, drawn-out, halting conversation about this ineffable evil. Eventually, Odin breathes something about the world beyond.
I want to point out one thing. Mm-hmm. The world before Wikipedia, Odin has two eyes.
Oh, yeah.
Norse mythology, one eye, two ravens.
Oh, I didn't even think about that. But yeah, you're right.
Oh, the world before Wikipedia, mm-hmm. That's all I'm going to say.
Odin eventually mentions the world beyond, and Thor is like, gasp! I have heard of the world beyond, and I've always been too afraid to ask about it. And so naturally I want to say, well, we in the audience have never heard about the world beyond. You're just pulling this out of your ass. But what else is new, right?
Yep. With the ridiculous hats in Asgard?
Eh.
I mean, I'm looking at Thor's hat, and I'm like, it's a helmet with wings on it. It's kind of goofy. Like, you think they'd put, like, a horned Viking helmet on it, even though that's not historically accurate.
Nope.
You think horned Viking helmet. Or lots of horned Viking helmets in the Asgardians. No. These guys have headwear that is progressively more and more bizarre as you go by panel to panel. There's a guy with a kidney bean on his head, for crying out loud.
Yeah. So, eventually, Odin is prodded into moving the plot along, and he mentions that, I've already dispatched the Warriors 3 to what is surely their deaths. So the Warriors 3 are basically dead before the story even begins. We'll be revisiting that topic in the second half of this episode. Then Thor says something to the effect of, well, who is to blame for this evil? Is it Galactus? And Odin's like, don't be a moron, Thor. Galactus has just ate a planet, so he's going to be, you know, lounging on his giant rocky Barca lounger for 4 or 5 months or so. And there's even a panel depicting, hey, here's Galactus. He looks all tuckered, and you know he's had his Thanksgiving meal for the year.
Yep.
So he'll be out. And before you ask, no, it's not the Mangog either, because you've probably already forgotten that you've banished him from all of existence a couple issues ago. They have a picture of the Mangog, who I think is supposed to be the Magog, who is like the destroyer character from Babylonian myth, who gets a lot more play over in DC. but no, it's not him. And before you ask, no, it can't be Loki either, because Loki has been exiled after this whole ring stealing fiasco. So yeah, his ass is in, I don't know, hell or something, as is seen in this panel. So that's three whole panels we wasted explaining other villains who are probably not going to be in the story.
Yeah. The magic window of smoke and fire that Kidney Bean Head conjures up at Odin's behest is just basically a big star map. This interactive star map that they're standing in is like, well, there's this big black splotch over here with no worlds in it. So is that the terror from the world beyond? Yeah, that is. And it's like, well, it must be Galactus, because I guess he ate everything. Well, no, it's not Galactus. He's tuckered out. And then Mangog, who I've never heard of before and will surely never be mentioned again.
He's got weird, stumpy little hands.
He does.
He's supposed to be like 600 feet tall, and yet I feel like I could hold more in my hands than he could hold in his.
Yeah.
It's weird. Brendan, yeah, they did mention this point that the threat from the world beyond is like a giant black hand that is just smearing itself across the galaxy and erasing planets and stars in its wake. Thor at some point says, wait, if the giant black hand from the world beyond is destroying all of existence, then that means Earth could possibly be at danger. And I know the thing about Earth is it is mostly a giant muddy shitball that is riddled with crime and hatred and ugliness and war and crying black kids. But damn it, I still love it and I still want to protect it, as evidenced by this panel, which is a photo collage of greed and ugliness and war and crying black children.
Yeah.
You'll have to take my word for it. I have come across so many panels depicting exactly that. It kind of makes you wonder, like, why do the superheroes want to save us?
Yeah.
If that's what they believe that Earth is. And also, I guess I should probably as well mention, wait a minute, is the Norse pantheon turning their noses down on us humans and our propensity for waging war? isn't a world of unending, unceasing war like their idea of heaven?
Yeah. From what I know about the Norse pantheon, it's like, yeah, if you don't die in battle, you died a shitty, shitty death.
Mm-hmm. And also that they're upset over our propensity for crime and, like, you know, stealing things when they were championed by the Vikings who were a society of institutionalized banditry.
Yeah.
They kind of had to pillage other people in order to survive. You know, check your privilege, I guess, is what I'm saying.
It's only cool when they do it.
Hey, let's hear about something else that's incredibly stupid. Did I ever tell you about the Odin sword?
Why, no. You never told me about the Odin sword.
So, the Odin sword is this comically ginormous long sword that's usually, like, lying somewhere in Odin's throne room, or in this case, it's, like, hovering off the ground. And it's so goddamn big. We're actually going to see giants later, like, creatures that were, like, 10, 12, 16 feet tall, maybe. And even they would probably just have to drag the thing behind them like a Pyramid Head's knife. It's like the size of a 747's wing.
Yeah.
And this thing has cropped up quite a few times in previous issues. So apparently the sword is constantly just fighting to edge out of its scabbard, and if it ever becomes fully unsheathed, then the world will end. Or, like, all of existence will end.
Yeah.
So Odin, and only Odin, is boss enough to, you know, push the damn thing further in its scabbard. And he has to, like, take time out of every single day to do that. You know, it really says something about my inherent love of Marvel Comics that I just assumed this is something from actual Norse mythology. So I decided to look it up, and hey, guess what? No, it's not.
Yeah.
Nor is the Odin ring, but like you needed me to tell you that. You know, Marvel's been kind of fast and loose with what they adapt and what they make up about Norse mythology. Like, their idea of Loki is not just the god of mischief, but a straight-up god of evil. You know, a guy who kind of wants to just rule and or kill everything because he hates everyone else so goddamn much. And yet, they've never adapted that bit from actual Norse mythology in which Odin forced Loki to turn into a sexy female horse and bang a bunch of other horses to give birth to his sweet eight-legged super horse.
Yeah. There's some crazy, like, stuff going on in Norse mythology.
That would have pissed me off if you might ask me to do that, but no, that's... Rather have giant floating swords.
Yep.
And we're almost arrived at the point of this whole comic. So here's where Odin decides to actually tell us the name of the unfathomable cosmic entity that is about to kill us all. Infinity. And so naturally when I read this the first time, I said to myself, this has something to do with, like, the Infinity Stones. You know, the six MacGuffins that all of Marvel movies have been Infinity Gauntlet. Or the Infinity Gauntlet, or Thanos himself, because after all, there was the, you know, Thanos invaded Earth, like, back in 2011 or so in the comics, and that event was called Infinity. So is it that? No, of course not. And you're a goddamn idiot for thinking that. No, Infinity is a brand new entity called Infinity that is only in this arc and will never be mentioned again. Thor is like, hey, Dad, who's that guy? That guy standing over there in the corner who's just been scowling at us this whole time we've been in here. And Odin's like, that is the Silent One. He showed up here a couple days ago, has never said anything, has just been standing there, and I trust him implicitly. I assume with my mighty imperial mind that he will be really, really important in thwarting this imminent danger. So Thor, he's staying in your room. And Thor's like, come on, Dad, he's probably a spy for Infinity. So let's beat it out of him. So Thor throws himself bodily at the Silent One, and the Silent One completely no-sells his attack, or, like, repels him. Yeah, like, he's got some sort of force field.
Yeah.
And Odin's like, how dare you, my dearest heroic son? The Silent One is our guest, and you shall treat him as such. And then Thor hurls his hammer through the Silent One, and the Silent One just sort of, like, phases it through his body, and it comes out the other side. Damn it, Thor, you're an asshole. I'm leaving. So you remember how we just established that Odin has to push that fucking sword back in the scabbard or the world will end?
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, forget that. I'm going to throw myself bodily into the world beyond, you know, and probably die. So long, guys. So he just leaves.
I love the best part. He's like, the power to slay the Silent One is mine alone, but I choose to wait, to brood, to seek an answer and in my own imperial way, which means I'm leaving and you're in charge until I get back. Mm-hmm. After you've amply proved you can't be in charge of anything, I'm leaving you in charge. Mm-hmm.
And by you, do you think he's talking to Thor or the Silent One?
Honestly, probably the Silent One.
Yeah, well, if that's the case, then, you know, Odin basically summons a boom tube or, you know, some portal to travel to the world beyond. He steps through it, and the Silent One just follows him through the portal. Yeah. So, the plot is actually kind of, sort of, maybe starting with this next page. Because you remember how I said how Odin was so damn sure that Loki cannot possibly be a threat because he's in exile forever mm-hmm. and whatnot. So he leaves. Loki is apparently so far in exile, he's like a couple blocks away from the palace. And he sees Odin's, I don't know, spirit portal thing take off. And he's like, ha-ha, my exile was conditional on the fact that Odin stay in the palace. So now that he's gone, I'm free to return to Asgard and wreak my horrible vengeance.
That's the most retarded exile I've ever heard. Okay, you're yep. banished into exile for as long as I remain under house arrest.
Mm-hmm.
I can't go on vacation, can I? No, sir, you're under house arrest, essentially, so that your idiot adopted son can never leave his exile.
Yep.
Like, what if I want to, like, you know, head to the next number, go to Vegas, like, just play the slots. No, he'll bust out of his exile and come back here and screw everything up and start having Shakespeare in the Park while, you know, you're losing at table games. Oh, so I got to stay here the entire time. Well, don't worry, Odin. We'll get Netflix. You know, we'll get you cable TV and streaming service. You'll be fine. Yeah, that's the most idiotic constraint on the exile ever. But I'm looking at this page before, and it's the Silent One stands around where Odin is, doesn't say anything, and follows Odin wherever Odin goes. There's a calamitous event that's destroying the universe, starting at the edges and working its way in. And we've never seen the Silent One before, and we're never going to see him again. I know who the Silent One is. I've exactly worked out who he is.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. He's Odin's future regeneration that the Time Lord sent back because there was a chance Odin's body would get too badly damaged fighting the Master that he won't be able to induce regeneration himself, and he'll need his future self there to you know, induce the regeneration so he can survive.
Gee, that would have been great.
Yeah, that was the plot of Doctor Who, the Classic Who episode. Mm-hmm. I'm sitting there going, I am getting such a Legopolis feel off of this, on the first 10 pages of this book. It ain't funny.
Well, as I'm sure you're well aware, I know next to nothing about Doctor Who, so if...
Just tell me if a bitter, cynical, smart-mouthed Australian air stewardess is going to show up at any point in this.
No.
Damn.
Not even Australian. So, yeah, the plot of the rest of this issue, which it suddenly is striking me, is even more pointless than anything that's come before it. So, Loki hits up a collection of storm giants to talk them into invading Asgard. And you'll forgive after the Doctor Who reference, you'll forgive this Dungeons & Dragons reference. But I took a look at these guys and said to myself, wow, they look way more hill giant-y than storm giant-y to me.
Yeah.
Aren't storm giants supposed to be like the upper crust of giant society? They're all regal and groomed, and they're wearing like fine silks and jewelry, and they have those Grecian rings, you know, sewn into their beards.
Yeah, they don't have a charisma penalty, and these guys have at least a -4.
Yeah, and these guys are Mongoloid Neanderthals with, you know, sloping foreheads and
misshapen faces and you know, improperly proportioned limbs. These are totally hill giants. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know where Loki must have gotten turned around and landed in the wrong part of Jotunheim.
Yeah, but anyway, so he's like, yeah, let's go conquer Asgard, and they're like, yeah, let's do that. So then you cut to the next page, and Thor is I don't know touring the armory, saying like, yeah, I don't know if these swords are sharp enough to cut infinity in half. Maybe we need to make bigger swords. And then a messenger comes in and says, "Interim Allfather, Thor, your brother has invaded Asgard with an army of hill storm giants, and they've already kidnapped Baldur." And Thor's like, "You tell me something actually happened in this comic, and it was off-panel?" Fuck! Big fight scene with the giants. I find it so hard to actually comment about most comic book fight scenes, but there are two kind of interesting things that happen here. One of them is that eventually Lady Sif and her magnificent Vulcan eyebrows joins the fray. And, you know, she, it doesn't really matter how much ass she kicks. All the other giants would look at her and say, hey, check it out, a woman we can kidnap. That's all that really registers with them. So they try to kidnap her, and then Thor rescues her, because of course he does. And so after depositing the, you know, the frail maiden, goddess of war, Sif, on top of a high wall, then he rejoins the fray with a freaking Izuna leg drop. I don't know what it is. It's just the foreshortening, I suppose, of that panel is just hilarious.
It looks way too awkward.
But hey, guess what? Thor wins. And Loki's back in exile, I guess. They don't even really address what happened to Loki, frankly. Thor and Sif spend like an entire page making out. And then finally he's like, well, I guess I better go and follow my father into the world beyond. Yay, verily. End issue 184.
No, you're forgetting the part where as he's swapping spit with Lady Sif, the spirit of Odin appears and is signifying danger beyond belief. Yeah. And it basically says, your thunder god, heed my words. Bad stuff is coming. Bye now. It's like...
Were you aware of that?
Yeah. Do you remember the first 10 pages where I told you bad stuff was coming in a sufficiently vague manner? Well, it's still coming, and it's sufficiently vague. Goodbye.
So, issue number 185 starts. The cover very prominently features the friendly, jagged, hoary old face of the Silent One beckoning towards that big black fist crushing planets in the background. And he's like, hey, look at me. I'm the Silent One. I'm this great new character. I'm totally going to be really important in this issue. Just you wait. That's what I'd be saying if I could talk. How about I offer this as a question to you, Brendan, and you fine folks at home. How many pages of, catch-up, backstory do you think this issue is going to need to devote to cover all of the nothing that happened in the previous issue? How many would you guess?
Sane man would say one page tops. But this is 70s Marvel, and it's a flagship title, so the first third of the issue?
That would be like six pages or so. Ooh, it may as well be, but it's 3.5.
Oh.
3.5 full pages to describe vague evil from some place called the world beyond who might be called Infinity. Also, Loki had giants for like a hot minute.
Yeah, Loki had giants for 2 pages.
That took 3.5 pages to catch everyone up to.
Like Thor spent longer, flying Lady Sif to safety and then making out with her than he spent actually kicking the giant's ass. Mm-hmm.
So, eventually, Thor finds himself essentially in Steve Ditko land. He's in a murky, magical world with floating, thin platforms like Steve Ditko was fond of filling most of Doctor Strange comics with. So this is the world beyond, I guess. And who should be here but four-armed stone guy called the Guardian. So, Guardian's like, hey, let's fight now. Thor's like, okay. So they fight, and the Guardian is much like the Silent One, is pretty good at no-selling pretty much anything that Thor throws at him. Maybe he gets knocked down, but he just gets right back up again and says, ah, my master is a font of infinite power. While he is satisfied, I shall fight with the fury of 10,000 galaxies or whatever. And then Thor's like, wait, who's your master? Is that Infinity guy? And that's the password. Guardian's like, fuck, how did you know his name? He hates that. And then a booming voice just appears from the blackness saying, God damn it, Guardian, did you tell him my name? You had one job. And then Infinity is just so offended that someone said Infinity that he basically strikes Guardian insensate and he goes snoozing for the rest of the issue. What? This is a weird weakness, but maybe we'll kill Infinity just by saying his name over and over again, like he's Rumpelstiltskin or some shit.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, no, this never comes up again. Infinity just kind of goes on and on to say, hey, check what I can do. I can crush this planet in my giant black hand. Cool, huh? Yeah, that's what I'm all about. Well, goodbye. So the Silent One shows up again, just waves, hi. And Thor's like, God damn it, it's the Silent One, the first of two extremely powerful bastards that I fought. I guess I'll fight you again. So he just tries to kill him again. And the Silent One just pushes him away again. You know, maybe there actually is some truth in that old adage about people who only have hammers.
Yeah.
So the Silent One basically says to himself, well, I accomplished a lot today. I'm going to fuck off again. Then I think that here's where the scene where Thor sees another planet getting snuffed out by the Big Black Hand, but somehow he can see to the planet that, no, everything we've just said was a lie, that Eternity is not destroying the planets, he's brainwashing the entire populace of the planet. So that there's a scene of this alien city, and, you know, thousands upon thousands of aliens who are walking lockstep with glassy blank eyes, saying, ah, so this is what Eternity wants to do, and the only reason that we stop to do this is to gasp, set up what happens next page. Can you believe that? Like, foreshadowing? Actual Chekhov's guns in this story? Who'd have thunk it, right?
Foreshadowing doesn't count when it's literally setting up two panels later.
But, so, who should appear but the Warriors Three? Hey, guys! I'm so glad to see that you're still with us. And then the Warriors Three all draw their weapons with blank zombie expressions on their faces and start hacking Thor to pieces. And so Thor's like, well, I don't want to fight you guys because you're all friendly. Hey, I know what I can do. I can throw my hammer to create a portal back to Asgard and suck your three asses back to Asgard, where you're still, you know, mind-controlled. And not, like, you know, tell anyone at Asgard about this. So, goodbye. So the Asgardians, they have to smack the Warriors Three around. But admittedly, they do have the advantage in numbers. So eventually, they just stuff their asses into a cell.
Yeah.
So rejoining Thor, well, should I say Dr. Donald Blake? Because apparently, Thor's hammer took the Warriors Three back to Asgard. However long distance that is, and that took more than a minute. So when 60 seconds go by without Thor's hammer, Thor turns back into the weak, club-footed Dr. Donald Blake, which is a rather searing major weakness of Thor's that you think might want to teach him to adopt a fighting style that doesn't involve hurling his hammer long distances.
Yeah.
But he never seems to pick up on that.
So, he's not a bright boy.
So, yeah, so he's turned back to his puny mortal form, and Infinity's like, oh, hey, check it out. That Thor guy is really puny and bruised now. Hey, Guardian, you're back up. So the Guardian just wakes up again, and he moves to crush Donald Blake. And that's the end of issue 185.
That was a very short trip down Nothing Lane.
Mm-hmm. Hey, issue 186, well, this is going to pick up because look who it is. It's Hela, the goddess of death.
And very, very wicked-looking hats.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yes, Asgardians have stupid headgear, and if we're talking practicalities, that headgear is really, really stupid, but it looks badass. For a villain, that looks like a badass hat.
So, yeah, here we are, the one tie to the film we're going to review here in a moment. It's nice to see Hela, you know, show up in this completely nothing story. I bet you can't wait to find out how little she's actually going to matter. Mercifully, there is a very brief recap to all the nothing that's come before in the previous two issues, and we see Odin, who is, I don't know, just like firing lasers or something out of his hands at Infinity, I guess, off screen.
Yeah, or not. He's shooting hand lasers.
He's helping.
He's throwing up the hands of Palpatine.
So, of course, he in his infinite wisdom has detected that Thor, that his dear beloved son has reverted back to his pitiful human form. I think we're like a couple months before admitting that there never was a Donald Blake, and that was all a big trick that Odin is just playing on his son to teach him humility. And this sweeping retcon to just forget about all this Donald Blake business. But yeah, I just decided to mention that now, just, you know, to make this seem even more cruel than it probably should be. But, so Odin's like, I'll cut the big lug of break here. Let me just, take my eyes off the prize for a brief period to throw a force push or something through the ineffable cosmos so it knocks the Guardian on its ass for just a couple seconds, allowing the hammer to return to Donald Blake, and he's Thor again.
Yep.
Yep. So.
And Thor just whacks the Guardian in the face once with Mjolnir, which knocks him unconscious, which didn't work last issue, but does work today.
Well, he knocks him down again, but then Guardian just gets back up again, because, you know, he's a Chumbawamba fan. So there's a drawn-out fight scene that is exactly as pointless as the first fight scene with the Guardian. Here, instead of, oh, I don't know, saying Infinity again, Thor's like, okay, so it seems to me that Infinity, like, gives him a jolt of, I don't know, stamina or something every time I knock him down. So what if I throw my hammer in a circular motion around the Guardian to provide a shield that will hopefully filter out whatever cosmic juju that Eternity juices Guardian with a arbitrary number of seconds after he hits the canvas. So he does that, and it works, and the Guardian's never seen again.
Why not wait till Thor loses interest in spinning his hammer around the Guardian and turns to walk away, and then hit the Guardian with another bolt and res him? Like, does he only get one shot?
Yep. Let's say that that's how this plot works, and move on, shall we? So now Thor can see Odin. He's gotten to where Odin is on the, you know, this epic precipice cliff overlook where he's firing force lightning into Eternity. He's like, I shall help you, father. But then the Silent One's like, not on my watch, motherfucker! Well, is what he would say if he talked. But so the Silent One is just interposing between Thor and Odin. He doesn't want Thor to help him. So instead, the Silent One gestures into some other direction, and Thor's like, I trust you implicitly, brother Silent One. Let's go there. So he does. So, back in Asgard, Baldur's... it's either this issue or the following issue where Baldur says the thing that Baldur always goddamn says whenever he's at a crisis. You know, if he's at a moral quandary, he looks deep inside himself and says, I know what'll solve this. I'll go to Carnilla, evil queen of the Norns, the vile witch who wants to sleep with me, and I'll string her along and, you know, and make a Faustian bargain with her to get her to help out. That'll probably damn my soul. I've done it like 60 times by now. You know, it's not really worrying anymore. So yeah, that's what he does. All right, we're finally here. We're at the show-stopping grand finale of this whole mad adventure we've been having tonight. You ready for this?
Yep.
So Thor, following his bestest buddy in the whole world, the Silent One. Silent One takes him to his boss, Hela. Goddess of death, sworn enemy of Asgard and all that fucking lives. And Hela's like, you morons, did you guys realize that the Silent One was my, you know, cabana boy? The Silent One, he may never speak, he may never feel, but he is my eyes and ears, and he has shown me all your weaknesses. You morons trusted the Silent One when you had no reason to, so while I'm here, I will drain your youth, Thor. I can do that, you know? So Thor just starts aging, and Hela's like, ha ha ha, ultimate revenge is mine. Well, I'm off. I'll see you in the movies, Thor, my brother, uncle, or whatever you are, whatever relation I am with you in this continuity. Bye! Yeah, by the way, she's supposed to be like Loki's daughter. Originally, I don't know how they intended to swing that exactly, but whatever.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's all Hela does in this whole book. And, you know, you may think it's enough because Thor is going to, you know, age himself into non-existence. But that's when his bestest buddy, the Silent One, looks down at his pitiable form. And while Thor is still trying in vain to fight the good fight, saying, as long as I draw breath into my raggedy old lungs, I will oppose you, Hela, and all your evil. And the Silent One, who is a servant of evil, is so impressed by Thor's pluck and determination that he's like, you know what I'll do for you, old buddy Thor? I will break the spell of aging and in so doing kill myself.
Okay, so the Silent One helps trigger Thor's regeneration, not Odin. So the Silent One is actually...
So close, Brendan!
Thor's previous... Thor's next incarnation from the future, sent back by the Time Lords, triggers regeneration.
But, wasn't the Silent One the sensational new character of this or any year? Because he's dead now. And he never comes back.
Yeah, that was a letdown. That was an absolute letdown. Mm-hmm. So, the reveal is the Silent One works for Hela. Hela shows up. Boom! Ages Thor. I'm out of 5,000. She fucks off to somewhere else, some other comic, you know, somewhere. Doesn't care. Another plot line. I'm done. Doesn't even mention Infinity. Doesn't come up at all. Like, she may not even be aware this Infinity cat is doing stuff. And Thor's aged. And I'm like, okay, that's kind of weird. But if you make that be the cliffhanger, Thor's aged. And, you know, let's get an issue of ancient Thor trying to, you know, struggle his way out of Hela's domain to get back in the fight. and, you know, later on, give him his youth back, not literally the next page.
Mm-hmm. And also, it's the Silent One who is moved emotionally to make this sacrifice, because, after all, did Hela not say, like, four panels ago, that the Silent One cannot feel?
Yeah.
And that's, again, as much foreshadowing as we're giving to this brave and noble sacrifice. But why wouldn't the Silent One want to surrender his existence for the sake of Thor, the guy who has primarily just tried to kill him?
And I love how Odin's like, yeah, I let the Silent One hang out in my castle because I sense that he is key to all of these events. Odin, you're dumb.
Yeah, he's not really.
He's not key to anything. He's working for Hela, who's nothing to do with Infinity. And if you actually, and since Odin says, I know how to destroy the Silent One, but I alone may do so. Odin, if you'd squish the Silent One, the entire side quest of Thor buggering off and getting aged by Hela to be, you know, restored by the Silent One, that wouldn't happen, and you wouldn't get brainwashed by Infinity on the last page of this issue.
Yeah, that's how it ends, with Odin getting the Mind Zomb treatment, and so there's promising a duel to the death between father and son in the next issue. And frankly, I am so goddamn bored, I'm not even really tempted to continue. I mean, I've read the next, like, four or five issues that it takes to finally auger this rambling, interminable arc to something resembling a conclusion. Would you like me to give you the brief overview, or do you care enough, or what?
Let me just fast forward a bit till I actually see what Infinity looks like. Did they show him at all? They've got to show him. They got to have a villain reveal, damn it!
He's a big black hand.
That's it? He's just the big black hand?
As far as I know, yeah.
Weak.
And Odin defeats him by securing himself in some kind of soundproof chamber where he sleeps the Odin sleep, and he learns ineffable cosmic knowledge and uses that knowledge to think eternity into death. And then he wins. But it's not over yet. Oh no, because Hela is really mad that Thor somehow, tricked the Silent One into killing himself to revive Thor. So Hela's really gunning for Thor now, and Thor has to hide on Earth in the puny mortal guise of Dr. Donald Blake, because Hela does not know about Donald Blake. So that's the only place where Thor will be safe from Hela and her bitchin' awesome furry hat. Ha ha! I thought you might like to hear that. Like two or three issues after where you are. Hela in her mortal disguise, which of course includes a high collared Dracula cape and an enormous furry Cossack hat, and also she tends to just walk in through thin air. So I don't really think she's thought terribly hard about this whole, hiding amongst the rabble of humanity sort of angle.
God, they all have stupid hats. Are you from Asgard? How could you tell? You've got a stupid hat. If the collar on her cloak wasn't so redonkulously high, and the hat wasn't that hat, maybe, maybe, but I get the feeling that character design just wasn't a strong point for Marvel in the 70s.
Honestly, I'm just glad that no one's wearing pirate boots.
Thor.
Maybe that was more of a disco era thing.
Apart from Thor.
Geez, everybody in the 70s had that. Even if they were in, like, Killraven's universe, which is, like, you know, 50 years in the future after the fall of man and the rise of the Martians. Like, pretty much everyone's wearing thongs and pirate boots. Those are the only clothing that survived. Anyway, so eventually Hela corners Dr. Donald Blake, but Sif is there to plead that Hela take her instead in order to leave Thor alive. And Hela's like, I have learned an invaluable lesson about the power of love. I never thought that anyone would sacrifice themselves to save Thor, despite the fact that the Silent One just did that, and that's why I'm so mad. So, I shall leave you and Sif both alive. Thank you, Lady Sif, for reminding me what it is to be a woman. I'm not really paraphrasing much here.
Yeah, you're really not. I just found that panel. I just read that. I just read the speech balloon. I'm like, yeah, she said that.
So is that it? Is the saga of eternity over now? Or sorry, is this... Is the Saga of Infinity over now?
I hope so. It's terrible.
Well, no, because when they get back, what do they discover? That during the confusion, Loki, who I guess no one thought to, pick up after, you know, find him after the whole giant invasion, he stole the Odin Ring again. So he's king again. Just like 10 issues ago. So do you guys understand why I haven't read the other Essential Thors yet?
Yeah, there's not really any point. The likelihood that they get better is just not really all that. It's infinitesimal. They're only going to get dumber and dumber and dumber the farther along you go.
I do feel like Thor sort of has a bit of the Superman problem. He's just, when he's so goddamn powerful, and even more so, he's also usually a member of a team of many other extremely powerful people, that you kind of run yourself ragged thinking of things to oppose him, or coming up with really nonsensical rules that say, ha-ha, this guy's in charge now. Or, ha-ha, the sword is falling out of its sheath. That means the world's going to end. Ha-ha, because this guy's not here to put it back in. Ha-ha. It'd be so much simpler if he had just had to deal with kryptonite or something, right?
Yeah.
But, I'm so goddamn bored with these Thor stories that, you know, maybe I'll be the bigger man and actually read through 5, 6, and 7 at some point in the near future to let you guys know if you've been missing anything. Just like in the movies, Thor is perhaps not the most, you know, electric and exciting character, and so maybe people say that, you know, his stories are the weakest of the great wide, you know, tapestry. But maybe that's going to change with our review of Thor Ragnarok. What do you say?
Possibly, yeah.
Yep, I'm ready to get to it. I get started into that after the break, of course. We'll be back before too long. Yay, verily.
Hey, folks at home. It's time once again for my mid-break pick of the day, where I draw your attention to another fine internet media product here on Geekade.com. You're moments away from our Thor Ragnarok review, but in case you'd also like to see a review of the selfsame film in a non-auditory, text-based format, then Alex Zwizek has you covered. Just head on over to our articles page and find Zwy Reviews' Thor Ragnarok, a.k.a., quote, "Oh God, an enjoyable Thor movie," 3 question marks, end quote. Zwizek. Fuger. Christodoulou. Since I've started doing these, I've learned to pronounce so many names.
So, Thor 3, Thor mm-hmm. Ragnarok,
mm-hmm.
Thor, the first Thor movie I actually wanted to see, as opposed to felt obligated to see.
I'm glad you think so, at least about the third movie. Maybe I'm just an enormous mark for the MCU. Maybe I just like the MCU too damn much, but I never disliked the first two Thor movies. I mean, I
didn't dislike Thor 1 and 2. I just felt like Thor 1 I only watched because, okay, it's you know, they're setting up this guy, he's going to be in the Avengers, they got to watch this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Thor 2 I watched because they're going to do stuff in this that will somehow play into the Avengers 2, so I have to go see it. I didn't want to go see it, and after watching it, I didn't think it was a bad movie, but I felt like this movie didn't need to be made at all. They could have tacked 15 minutes on to another better Marvel movie and just, you know, saved the money and spent it somewhere else. Mm. It wasn't bad, but it was so utterly forgettable. It's like, a Thor movie happened. He punched Christopher Eccleston in the face. Some comedic actors showed up and embarrassed themselves, and Natalie Portman collected a paycheck for the last time from Disney Marvel. Okay.
Yeah,
on to Thor 3, which had a trailer that made, you know, that everyone mm-hmm. who saw the trailer was like, yeah, we're clearing our schedule.
Mm-hmm.
You see that in the theater, and the response to that trailer in the theater is like, it's everyone in the room unanimously saying, we are clearing our schedule to see this.
You know the first thing I thought of when I saw the trailer for the first time? I flashed back to that scene from Civil War in which Thunderbolt Ross is dressing down all the Avengers and saying, like, you know, the government would be really mad with me if I misplaced any, you know, nuclear warheads. But what you can't tell me where the Hulk and Thor are right now. And if Tony Stark said, actually, they're on a alien junk planet fighting each other in a gladiatorial arena overseen by Jeff Goldblum. Like, what do you think Ross would do? Would he just slap him or what?
I think he would slap him. And he'd be like, whap. Shut up.
But yeah, I too was really fond of the trailer. I was fond of it that it used Immigrant Song from Led Zeppelin, because you almost never hear Led Zeppelin songs used to advertise anything.
Or if you do, you don't hear Immigrant Song. And I will say that they, not only did they use it in the trailer, they used it in the movie.
Yeah,
because it was so omnipresent in the trailers that if they didn't put it in the movie, there'd have been riots in the streets.
Well, you say that, but Guardians of the Galaxy, the movie proper, didn't have a Spirit in the Sky in it, even though that was in all of the trailers. But granted, you know, a narrow soundtrack wasn't exactly a quality of any of the Guardians movies.
Yeah,
but yeah, you hear it not once but twice. You hear the Immigrant Song as many times in four movies as you hear Sabotage in Star Trek movies. Which is like, you don't feel like you should be hearing it, but they do, and it somehow works.
Yes, they play it during two fight scenes, one at the beginning and one at the end. It works both times. It's glorious.
There are two things I want to say about the movie before we start talking about it in any length. And one thing is, I swear I heard this in some like press releases. They said that, you know, they wanted to make Thor Ragnarok a self-contained story that you don't feel like you have to be a scholar of the rest of the MCU to understand what's going on. Which, of course, that's never a problem for me.
Yeah.
But I imagine it's a problem for other people. And then, so imagine my surprise when I watch this movie and say, wow, they're calling back to so many other movies.
Before you
including
see,
mostly movies that most people don't seem to like that much.
Yeah, before you watch Thor 3, watch Thor's 1 and 2, and Avengers 1 and 2. Let's see, and I think it's like there's one or two other callbacks they make. Those are the big four.
Yeah, like,
those are the big four.
Yeah, I don't think they mentioned anything that happened in the Hulk's only solo movie, but
yeah.
No one does that,
yeah.
Like, ever. Except for, I guess, Civil War, because it brought Thunderbolt Ross back.
Yep.
And no one mentioned how hypocritical it is that he's poo-pooing the Avengers for, you know, causing collateral damage when he unleashed a giant green rage monster that destroyed Harlem. But it was obviously put back together in time for Luke Cage to arrive, so
yeah.
We don't hold that against him anymore. But, so there's that, there's the surprising number of connections with other movies. And the second thing that I read on IMDb that horrified me to my goddamn core is the admission by the director Taika Waititi that roughly 80% of all the dialogue was ad-libbed.
Yeah, that scared me. That terrified me because, you know, an entirely ad-libbed movie is how you get the Ghostbusters remake-quel.
Yeah, you know that other Thor movie, Ghostbusters 2016?
Yeah.
That Chris Hemsworth was in?
Yeah,
he did a lot of ad-libbing that I don't think really added to much, but yeah, so like, a lot of people are at least talking, if not complaining, about the unendingly jokey tone of this movie is named after the Norse apocalypse.
Yeah, this movie's a comedy. Mm-hmm. That is straight up, it's not a personal opinion of mine. The director has said, I was making a comedy. If you know, do not complain that the serious scenes in the movie are undercut by immediate one-liners. The serious scenes are there to set up the immediate one-liners.
Mm-hmm. I laugh quite a lot in this movie. I didn't laugh at everything,
yeah.
But I think I could tell it's not just that they're ad-libbing, it's that they probably ad-libbed a hell of a lot more in this scene, but a judicious editor took it out.
Yes.
To keep the plot moving.
You could see that this movie...
That is one thing that they definitely did not do in the Ghostbusters movie.
Exactly. There was an editor who came behind and said, okay, these lines work, these lines don't, let's clip these lines out. Your comedic timing is off, the joke is dragged out too long in the middle. We'll cut a piece of the middle out, and then the timing becomes better. There was definitely editing that makes it flow, such that if someone didn't tell me 80% of the dialogue was ad-libbed, I never would have guessed. Rambling, incoherent monologues or dialogues between two characters that just go nowhere. Everything in this movie serves a point. It's like they said, okay, you can ad-lib this dialogue, but you must get from point A to point B in this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
You start here and you end here. I don't care how you get there, you gotta get there, you know, or, you know, you don't go home and eat tonight.
Yeah. I think that's a pretty fair assessment. I mean, I myself, I way prefer scripts than improving, myself, but you can find a happy medium.
Yeah,
and I think
I don't mind a script that an actor says, actually, you know what? Wouldn't it be funnier if I said this here? Mm-hmm. And the director goes, yes, that would be funnier. You may change that line. I'm generally more in favor of situations like that because an actor and a good actor and a good director, you know, can sit down and polish a script on set as they're filming. Fully ad-lib stuff, Ghostbusters 2016 left a very bad taste in my mouth, but Thor Ragnarok kind of washed that out. If you got an editor, you got a director who knows what he's doing, you got an editor who has a very sharp pair of scissors and some glue, you can do wondrous things, and Thor Ragnarok is a wondrous thing.
What can I say? I mean, I was really impressed by this film, and so I find myself at crossroads. Like, you know, usually when I utterly despise a film, then I take great pride in spoiling the fuck out of it in its entirety. When I give a moderate recommendation to a movie, maybe I give, like, a sort of a character rundown, and I talk about characters in turn, and so, and therefore, when I mention plot points, they're not necessarily in chronological order, so it makes it, you know, it makes it a bit better. But when I really like a movie, like in this case, I, you know, say as far away from spoilers as humanly possible. But in this case, honestly, dude, I kind of want to talk about at least like the first third to maybe the first two-fifths of this movie, and then there's a moment where there's a big cutoff, and I think I can like let the rest of it go. That's where I'm standing. How about you?
I kind of just want to like talk about characters and very broad strokes. I really don't want to go into specific details because, like, if you talk about the opening, you ruin the ending. Mm. Because attentive viewers...
Yeah.
There's a point in the movie where attentive viewers who are paying attention to the opening go, I know how this ends. Like, two-thirds of the way through the movie, I know exactly how this is going to end.
Well, if we're being totally pedantic, isn't the name of the movie kind of that spoiler, too?
The fact that it's called Ragnarok is not a spoiler because there's no guarantee based on the title of what will actually happen. Thor 2 is called The Dark World. It doesn't mean that the world ended. Or that the sun went out, and that everything was black, and you know, that Christopher Eccleston succeeded in his elfie ambitions.
No, it means that Svartalfheim is, like, the dark world where all the elves who live there are really keen on darkness.
Yeah, they didn't spend a lot of time in the movie there. They just basically punched Chris Eccleston in his elfie makeup face. Yeah, the title alone isn't that much. It doesn't necessarily need to be a spoiler. I would talk about the characters... And things they do with the characters, and then maybe the broadest strokes of the movie, because if you start talking about the actual scenes... There's so much in every scene that is funny. Is it that you like? Really... All right, in the trailers, everybody laughed at the "he's a friend from work" joke.
Mm-hmm.
When you get to that point in the movie, you know it's coming, and it's not as
funny.
There's hilarious stuff.
They try to be so coy as to who his opponent's going to be in the big ring. Right?
There's so much around that line that is still hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
Loki's reaction when he sees the Hulk is gold. But the line, "he's a friend from work," is no longer funny.
Yeah.
So I don't want to talk about actual specific scenes because I want the audience,
I want our listeners to go
to the movie and be like, oh, wow, that was amazing. I didn't see that coming. That wasn't already, you know, that joke wasn't already told and set up for me.
Okay. Well, I'll split your way. I'll go back to the whole character rundown schema instead. So how about we start with the big man himself, Thor?
Yeah.
Thor is simultaneously the most serious character and also the most glib and funny character.
Yeah.
He kind of vacillates between that because, you know, when he's goofy, it's when there are the points when you expect him to be the most goofy, but he's also the one who obviously cares the most about the you know, cataclysmic storyline.
Yeah.
And is usually the one trying to get other goofier characters to help him out.
He wants to save the world, he wants to save the universe, and nobody else got time for that shit.
Mm-hmm.
And so
And he doesn't either. It's at certain points, like the very beginning, when he's in Muspelheim, the realm of the fire demons, and Surtur, the fire giant, the lord of fire, he's got him chained up and hanging from the ceiling, and he's all like, "Ha ha, Odin's son, the time of Ragnarok is nigh, for the stars prophesy that when my crown meets with the eternal flame of Asgard, I shall be infused with power to destroy," and Thor's like, "I am so over all this."
Yeah.
I am. Just like I myself, when I was reading, you know, 20 issues of cataclysmic world-ending faff in the comics, I'm just like, dude... Let's just move on at this point. I'd rather talk about how fun it is that I'm swinging around in this chain.
But he still cares. His attitude is, dude, stop monologuing. I'm here to hit you in the face with my hammer. Stop monologuing. It's embarrassing for both of us. Because we both know I'm going to hit you in the face with my hammer and this is how it's going to end. I'm going to beat you. His goals are serious. He wants to save the universe. But his attitude towards villains is more like, these guys are morons. They tie you to a chair. They monologue at you. They tell you their entire plan. So all you have to do is slip out of the ropes they've tied you with. Mm-hmm. And then you hit them in the face with your hammer and you've won because you know exactly how to stop them. Like, Loki doesn't reveal his entire plan. Mm-hmm. So he's a little bit better, except that you can always predict him to betray you in the end. So if you anticipate the betrayal, you can short-circuit Loki's plans. Like, in the comics, Thor's got a thing where he's hot-headed and he's rash and doesn't think anything through. And by Thor 3, we're seeing a Thor who's figured it out.
Yeah.
He plans things better than he has before. Now, he's not a master strategist, but he's at least able to plan a couple of steps ahead. Thor has actually had, development across the past two films, and now we're seeing the culmination here, where Thor has never been ready to be the leader. He's always trying, take charge, he tries to take charge, he always tries to, solve a problem, but he doesn't try to get other people to follow along. He just I'm going to charge and swing my hammer at this, and if you guys follow along, that's great. In this one, he's actually trying to get people to work as a group towards a goal. Thor's character development of the past two movies really pays off in this.
Which he kind of did in Dark World, if anyone remembered that. But
no one remembers Dark World.
Well, I did, because I watched both Thor movies before the day before I went to see this. Which is fortunate, because, man, there's some scenes where that really paid off.
But yeah, I liked Thor in this a lot. And I've liked Thor in the Marvel movies. He's never been I've never found him an unlikable character. But he's always been kind of boring to me. He works great in the ensemble cast in the Avengers. Because he's got a lot of great people he can play off there. In his solo movies, he just didn't spin my wheels. I didn't get much out of them. This one, I'm really enjoying Thor in this. Even when he doesn't have a running crew to play off of, when he's not with the Hulk, when he's not with Valkyrie, when he's on his, like you said, when he's in, when he's talking to Surtur, it's like, yeah, he's great by himself, just dealing with the villain and essentially, without mocking the villain, mocking the villain.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, I love Thor in this.
Mm-hmm. After his cunning escape from Muspelheim, then we meet a brand new character. One I absolutely want to talk about, Carl Urban as Scourge the Executioner.
Scourge the Executioner, for those of you who are familiar with the character from comics, is not Scourge the Executioner from the comics. He is a much softer, more morally decent guy who just wants fame and recognition, and he's willing to do a lot of questionable things to get them, but he's got lines he won't cross, and he's morally conflicted throughout the film. Now, I'm not spoiling this when I say Scourge the Executioner gets Scourge the Executioner's ending from the comics.
Mm-hmm.
You put him in the movie, people are coming here because they want to see Scourge go out the way he went in the comics.
Well, I myself wasn't really expecting to see that. I was expecting to see Carl Urban finally join the MCU, because I've been wanting him to for, ever since I saw Dread.
I would love to see Carl Urban get more work in stuff like this and become a recurring character, but when you see him, you see Carl Urban is Scourge the Executioner, and he's got a pair of M16s. Okay, I know exactly how this character is ending in this film.
Yeah, I do love how when Taika Waititi was talking about how he mainlined the celebrated Walt Simonson run of Thor in the 80s,
mm-hmm.
And the one major appearance of the Executioner was him wielding twin assault rifles like he's playing GoldenEye. And he just says, yes, that's going in my movie. So he showed off, while he's so committed to his awesome new job as the new Heimdall, because Odin fired Heimdall for declaring, hey, Odin, I'm committing treason in the second movie, and then he didn't go to trial because he was replaced by Loki at the end of that movie, and we just sort of forgot about Heimdall, oops.
Yep.
So Scourge is the new watchman at the gates, and he spends that time mostly trying to, seduce women with his giant pile of Earth swag.
Yeah.
Including a moped, one of those goddamn shake weights, which apparently the director has a major, like, axe to grind of that thing. And also, of course, his twin assault rifles, which he got from the Midgardian realm of Texas. I call this one Des, and call this one Troy. Because...
You put them together and they destroy.
Are your ladies wet yet?
Yeah, he's... Scourge the Executioner is initially a scene of a source of a lot of humor. Then he becomes, you know, he's more conflicted about events that go on. But yeah, Scourge
And then, of course, he becomes suborned to the main villain who doesn't kill him because, I don't know, she recognized him from the craft services table at Lord of the Rings.
Well, when she pops in, three of the four people in the room challenge her authority. She ends those three people, and the guy's like, "I'm the janitor. I'm not challenging your authority." She's like, "You get to live." Mm-hmm. Her motivation. Well, let's jump right from Scourge to Hela. Mm-hmm. Hela's motivation is to rule Asgard, not to kill everybody there. She has to kill everybody there to take over because they refuse to submit to her will. Mm-hmm. But her wanting to rule Asgard is not her wanting to kill everyone. Now, in fact, after she has her first big fight scene where she kills a bunch of dudes, she actually says, "This annoys me more than anything else. Mm-hmm. Good warriors dying for no reason."
Yeah.
I really liked Hela in this because she's not the mustache-twirling nihilist that she could have been.
Mm-hmm.
She's crazy mad for conquest. She's got a 10-mile erection for war, but she doesn't want to destroy all life in the universe. She just wants to take everything over because
conquest is what she's good at, and it's what her dad once wanted of her.
Yeah, it's what her dad wanted.
I don't want to spoil too much, but hey, guess what? The fact that she's the villain of this movie, mostly Odin's fault.
Yeah.
Kind of like how, you know, Odin decided not to inform Loki that he was actually a frost giant, he was adopted, or how he... After the Dark Elves invaded Asgard and killed his wife, and you know it was time to retaliate, he decided just to kind of sit on his ass and brood.
Yeah,
and so Thor had to commit to high treason in order to get the movie going again.
Yeah,
so that was mostly Odin's fault, also.
Yeah,
he gets the hat trick in this movie. Let's just say that.
Yeah, so Hela as a villain, she's got a great hat. When she decides to wear it, which is when she's kicking ass. I love her hat.
I look forward to the next couple Comic-Cons, you know, seeing a bunch of cosplayers of her, you know, getting their antlers tangled together and caught on doorways.
Walk sideways through doorways, folks. Just going to throw that out right now. Walk sideways through doorways. I really liked Cate Blanchett's performance. Hela, I mean, she's villainous, but like I said, she's not a strong nihilist. Mm-hmm. She wants to conquer. She wants to rule Asgard. She wants to conquer all the universe, all creation.
Yeah, it was very easy for her performance to go camp. You know, she's the first super villainous in an MCU movie.
Yeah,
and you know she could have basically been Rita Repulsa, but maybe with less of a predilection towards mentioning Krispy Kreme.
Yeah,
She was kind of like that, but she still had a depth to her that I actually felt kind of sorry for her.
She was like
when she rediscovers that vault where her giant wolf friend Fenris and all of her awesome metal as fuck zombie Viking army is. I'm like, good for her.
Yeah, she. I wouldn't say she was camp. She was definitely vamp through all of her scenes, but. Yeah, she's handled very well. Cate Blanchett does a great job in the performance. The writers did a good job giving her depth. That she is mildly sympathetic in that she was raised to be a thing and to do one thing. She did that too well, and her dad was terrified of the result, and so he locks her away. And it's like, it's not entirely her fault she's a psychopath. She was raised to be one, and by a man who then she, you know, decided, yeah, you're too psychopath for me. I'm going to lock you up in exile and, pretend you never existed and that I never did the things that, you know, that we did together.
Just paint over your awesome mosaic tiles in my ceiling.
Yeah, it's like, she has a great line where she's like, all this gold in the palace came from conquest. And Odin was, you know, thrilled to have it.
A wise king never seeks out war, you know, Thor.
Yeah, it's like, he was you know, thrilled to have all the gold, but so embarrassed by what he did to get it. But yeah, Odin does not come off well in this movie.
There's some people, and he very easily could have come off worse. All those dailies about, you know, psychotic hobo Odin.
Yeah,
that they ended up reshooting to give him something more approaching dignity.
Yeah.
Instead of that, the showdown in New York City with homeless Odin. Now Odin is standing in repose on the shores of Norway because hey, we haven't been to Norway yet.
Yeah,
maybe we should do that.
And it's clear, you know, it's clear Odin knows exactly what is coming, and he knows that it's his fault. Yeah, yeah. Odin is dying with a lot of regrets at this point, and it is a somber scene that it needs to be.
Right.
Loki. Yeah, let's go to Loki now.
Well, I should probably mention that you obliquely talked about three people who opposed her and got struck down. I already sang about it, but yeah, she ices the Warriors 3.
Yeah.
Almost freaking immediately.
It literally, if you blink, you will miss it. It goes by that fast.
You will absolutely miss Fandral, so I totally understand why his actor is jumping ship to play Shazam in coming years. I do like that Hogan actually lasts the longest.
Yeah.
The guy who we basically push into a closet through the entirety of the previous movie.
Yeah, the guy we almost forgot to put in the second movie actually gets a fight scene in this movie, and he acquits himself well, but Hell is the god of death.
Mm-hmm.
Then that's what there is to say to it. Yeah, Warriors 3.
And also, Lady Sif, just not in this movie at all.
Yeah, she's not in it at all.
Apparently she had a scheduling conflict with her TV series.
The actress couldn't make
which
it.
That just sucks.
It leaves her open to show up in Thor 4.
Mm-hmm.
Or
She'll probably be in another episode of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. She's been in two of them before. And
yeah, she wasn't seen on Asgard during the proceedings, so she could show up later on. But yeah, Loki.
Oh, and also Darcy and Jane and Dr. Selvig, just gone.
Yeah, they're not
in this.
We briefly make a mention that Thor's not seeing Jane anymore, and that's all we need to talk about. And I'm like, okay, fine. That's all we need to hear. They're not dating anymore. Let's move on.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so sorry for all that housekeeping, but okay, Loki. Loki's Loki. He's as Loki as he's ever Loki'd.
But I think I think there's, towards the end of the movie, he's a better Loki than he's been.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean by a craftier Loki. I think the Marvel movies, Disney Marvel, is taking Loki not as God of Evil, but as God of Tricksters.
Yeah.
He's always got a plan. He's never going to tell you his plan, and he's always going to screw with you while he's on the way to his plan. And his plan is to make things better for him. But he's not malicious about most of what he does. And he's become less and less of a villain as the movies have gone on. And I think in this one is the one where he's still not a hero, but he's comfortable in being the anti-hero. It's like, you know, he'll help people out if he gets something out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of it, he won't stab them in the back when he's finished. He's like, I'll get what
he'll
I want
turn
out
into
of this.
A snake, and then he'll stab you.
Yeah, well, that was when he was a kid.
So I will say that, obviously, we have to resolve the cliffhanger at the end of The Dark World, in which he, in the guise of Odin, has been ruling Asgard in secret. And so, yes, they resolve that. I want so badly to tell you about that scene. But
don't. It's too glorious, because it shows Thor figuring it out. Thor's like, I just smarted. I hit a level that was divisible by 4, which means I got an attribute point. I put it in wisdom, and then I made a wisdom check and realized exactly who Odin, floating air quotes, Odin is, and now I'm going to out him in front of everybody. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, Thor figured it out, and don't spoil the fact that Thor figured out what Loki was doing.
Mm-hmm.
Loki is kind of the butt monkey of this movie.
A little bit, but
because he's always trying to be the dignified villain, and events are always conspiring to not let that happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think I'm pretty safe just leaving it at that, because I kind of want to talk about the Valkyrie.
Yeah, yeah, our new character for the film, Valkyrie.
So when the Valkyrie arrives, Thor's at a bit of a low point. He's been, you know, exiled to the trash planet, to the aforementioned trash planet,
mm-hmm.
and Valkyrie's there to essentially, you know, I don't know, enslave him. Is that the word we should be using to put him in the Glass War arena?
We don't like the word slave. We prefer prisoners with jobs.
Mm. Correct. So she shows up in her drunken badass glory,
mm-hmm.
And she's, you know, swaggering towards Thor, and then quick cut to a wider shot as she falls off a gantry and lands in the rotting carcass of some sort of bantha-like creature.
Yep.
And so I looked at that and I said to myself, damn! If only the Valkyrie's introduction in the comics was that efficient. I didn't mention this in the first half. I was kind of tempted to talk about a Valkyrie story, because I did like her so much in this movie, but that is such a convoluted Gordian knot of origins and false origins and retconned origins and body swaps and brainwashing and just and that's just like the 70s of like the Defenders era Valkyrie to a little bit in the 80s, and like her road is so just garbled and full of so many false starts and nonsense. It's aggravating. But it's also kind of amazing that she became such a strong character at the end of all of this, when most other writers would have been easier than just to throw her away and start again.
Yeah.
But yeah. So of course her intro is very quick and to the point. Also, I can only imagine Jessica Jones sitting next to me watching this movie saying, "Lightweight," and she downs 40 ounces of pop-offs. But. Yeah, so she is a sort of a drunken shell of her former self. When she used to be one of the Valkyrior, of course, and we do eventually see the flashback to her, her defining moment in combat with Hela. Imagine that coincidence, right?
Yep.
But it's, back in ye olden days when the world was essentially looked like a Ronnie James Dio album cover.
Yeah, they do the flashbacks in a different style than the rest of the movie.
And of course, Hela pretty much decimates the entire Valkyrie Corps. And it's just, you know, Tessa Thompson's character, and and there's a spear heading right for her heart, but blonde, braided-haired Valkyrie from the comics is like, no! And so she jumps in front and takes the fatal blow, and she may as well just turn to Tessa Thompson's Valkyrie and says, no, you must survive to piss off Trump supporters!
Yeah, we got an ethnic Valkyrie, and the thing is, I didn't realize we were getting Valkyrie in this movie, because I only watched the trailer, and I didn't really follow along with a lot of the stuff, the announcements going on to the side. So I see the film, and there's this drunken, angry warrior woman in this, and she's clearly physically capable. I'm like, okay, so we're on the trash planet, so I'm not even making the connection yet to that's potentially Valkyrie. I'm thinking, oh, she's probably just some character from, like, the cosmic stable of characters, because we're on trash planet, and so... It's she reveals a tattoo, and someone says, oh, and Thor's like, oh, you were in the Valkyries. I'm like, wait, she there's no, you were in the Valkyries. If that word pops up, then you know at that point, that's the character Valkyrie, that's her. Okay, so, you know, because literally I know that Disney Marvel is not marrying itself when casting actors, marrying itself to the visual template from the comics. I know that. But I'm still so used to the comic lore that I am anticipating a Caucasian woman with blonde hair as Valkyrie. And when I don't get that, I don't rage about it, but it's like, it does throw me for a loop. I'm like, oh wow, this is the Valkyrie we get, and yeah, we get this Valkyrie, and she's friggin' awesome.
Mm-hmm. And she definitely has the best character arc of any character.
Yeah, and, yeah. Because she's a brand new character in this. She's like one of the few major characters in this who's not, you know, Hela. Who's a important character who's brand new. Who's like, Loki's finishing up an arc, Thor's finishing up an arc, Hulk is finishing up an arc. So Valkyrie gets one mostly start to finish in this.
I'm absolutely fine with who they chose for this.
Yeah,
and I look forward to seeing her in some of the Avengers movies, because that, again, we don't want to spoil the ending, but it's obviously leaning towards an Infinity War.
Yeah,
and why would it?
They've been building up to the Infinity War since the first Avengers movie.
Actually could have leaned a lot harder into the Infinity War. Like, may I go as far as to say Heimdall's in this. And Heimdall's in a way more depressing movie than the rest of the characters seem to be.
Everyone else is in the funny parts of the movie, and Heimdall's in the part of the movie that sucks because, he's stuck on Asgard while Hela is wrecking shit.
Yeah, do you remember how there was a sort of a fan theory that Heimdall has the Soul Stone, the orange Infinity Gem inside him, which is why he has those amber eyes? No, he doesn't. That's not mentioned at all.
Yeah.
And also, I don't expect there to be another Infinity Stone on Asgard, because Sif and Volstagg mentioned that at the end of Dark World.
Yeah, they could only keep the one.
The ether to the collector because they can only keep the Tesseract, which of course makes an appearance.
Yeah.
As does that other Infinity Gauntlet that you of course remember from those two frames of the first Thor movie. That continuity hiccup gets dealt with in one goddamn word.
Yes,
so don't worry about that.
Yes, they do address the continuity hiccup gloriously.
So that's Heimdall and that's Valkyrie. Should we move on to Jeff Goldblum?
Yeah,
what can I say? Jeff Goldblum is the Grandmaster. He's
not in a lot of scenes, but every scene he's in, he robs from every other actor at gunpoint.
He's one of the elders of the universe from the comics, just like the Collector, which is why he kind of looks like he could be like Collector's brother. Mm-hmm. He has kind of sort of the same hair and complexion and accoutrements about himself. He's running the games in Sakaar, the trash planet, with Sakaar, by the way, also known as Planet Hulk, but you could probably assume that already.
Yeah.
Other than that, Jeff Goldblum is the Jeff Goldblumiest he's ever been. It's like Taika Waititi's like, hey, Jeff Goldblum, can you be Jeff Goldblum for this movie? And Jeff Goldblum's like, that would be the role that I was born to play. And so, yeah, I looked at Jeff Goldblum's performance and I said to myself, you know, I tend to edit out most of my stuttering in my show, but goddamn, he doesn't embrace his.
Yeah.
I wonder if I could ever be that confident with my speech patterns. But also made me realize, damn, if Jeff Goldblum and Hugh Grant ever headlined a movie, it would have to be at least 4 hours long. And me being me, I guess I should probably also mention, Topaz is in this movie.
There's a woman called Topaz, but there's literally no similarity in any way, shape, or form with any version of Topaz we've seen so far. We may not just be demonstrating that there is not a one Steve limit in this universe if you ever get an actual Topaz.
Yeah,
I don't know that we will.
Yeah, so the Grandmaster's Enforcer is this big, beefy woman named Topaz, and
she wears yellow-orange clothing. Yeah, maybe that's where she got the name from.
I sprained my glorious mind to come up with some, you know, connections like, you know, string on a freaking corkboard to draw her inspiration of her character from the Topaz in the comics, like from witches that I vivisected last episode. There's really no connection.
Yeah.
As always, it kind of comes back to the fact that there are so few female characters in comics compared to the two male counterparts that if you were to say, okay, so this cosmic dude needs a female bruiser-style, you know, bodyguard and right hand, so what character from the comics should it be? Well, Gamora's already taken, so as is Nebula, so I don't know, Titania, maybe? Or maybe the female Quasar? No, she wouldn't work. She wouldn't do that. I make up somebody, maybe named after Taika Waititi's birthstone or something.
Yeah,
and she's also played by one of Mr. Waititi's regular troupe of actors from his native New Zealand, which may as well introduce us to the man's role himself. The director is in the movie as Korg. The Cronin, the stone man from Saturn.
Yep.
Fun fact, the early scene from Thor of the Dark World, that you probably don't remember, in which Thor disintegrates a giant hulking stone man, that was a Cronin, a stone man from Saturn, and according to the script, his name was Korg. Because that's the only Cronin who has a name in all of comics, apparently. But so Korg and his buddy, the knife-handed little insect guy, Meek, who I wasn't aware that's how it was pronounced in the comics. It's spelled M-I-E-K-K. If it's Meek, that makes things easier for me. So, Korg and Meek are part of the Hulk's Warbound from Planet Hulk. There's quite a few more members of the Warbound, but there's only room for two characters, unfortunately. And wow, are they funny? They are the funniest goddamn thing about this this movie.
And Korg and Meek don't get that many scenes. They're in fewer scenes than the Grandmaster, but a lot of Korg's lines are laser accurate, perfect for the scene.
The personality that he gives him, apparently is patterned after, like, Polynesian bouncers.
Yeah, so I read that.
He's big and imposing, and yet he has the highest pitched to sweetest voice. Like, if Mike Tyson was actually a nice man.
The director, I think, also did the mocap for the character as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think he also did the mocap for Surtur.
Oh, I wasn't aware. I didn't know Surtur's voiced by Clancy Brown, by the way. So, another MCU double dipper, because he was the blacksmith from Daredevil Season 2 and the Punisher's CO. Yeah, really. We're recording this like a week before the Punisher's own series comes out on Netflix, and I think they're going to completely retcon that. So, I guess he's the old Kurgan spreading his wings, and he's gonna pick up another MCU villain.
They kind of condense the Planet Hulk. They take visual cues from Planet Hulk, but they don't take too much of the story from it.
Mm-hmm. Which, honestly, if you ask me, I'm fine with, because I think I mentioned this probably on the old show. It was like a year ago. I did read Planet Hulk and World War Hulk for the first time in its entirety. It was two Baltimore Comic Cons ago. And I gotta tell you, I didn't really care for Planet Hulk that much. It seems so basic. It's like, I've already seen the Hulk stranded in some bizarre alien world and forced to fight in Gladiatorial Arena. That was a story called The Beast Who Shouted Love at the Heart of the Atom, written by Harlan Ellison back in like the late 60s. I remember that from The Essentials. And he falls in love with the alien princess, a green-skinned woman named Jarella. And it's like, that's basically exactly what happens in Planet Hulk, and Greg Pak, the writer of Planet Hulk, who I've actually met, and he's a really sweet guy. I interviewed him once. He even admitted, like, yeah, I was kind of just asked to recycle that, and I even point that out at one point in the middle of Planet Hulk, saying, like, it was like Banner is screaming at Hulk, "Hulk, you've done this before! Don't you remember? It didn't work out that well for you the last time either." And still, Planet Hulk is like the greatest Hulk story that there's ever been, and I don't really see it. But, there already is a Planet Hulk animated movie, which I saw, and guess what? I didn't really care for all that much. But, I'm still glad that Planet Hulk was around, because it inspires, some cool pastiches in this film to just sort of, nibble on. But also it led to World War Hulk, which is the Hulk coming back to Earth and punishing everyone for civil war. Yay. So I'm all about that. But I should probably say that for another episode. But,
The visuals of the junk planet are breathtaking. Everything is CG. You know it's CG. You don't give a shit. It's so amazing. It's not quite up there with Doctor Strange's M.C. Escher world fights.
No, of course
but
not.
But the visuals are beautiful. The colors are bright.
Yeah.
Like this is... People complain about Hollywood washing the palette out of the color palettes of a lot of movies. Yeah, not in this. Oh, no. My God. Like when Hela's wandering around, Hela-ing everything up, the color palettes are very muted. Except for the greens of the eyes of the living dead. When you get to the junk planet, it looks like a four-color comic book.
No, it looks like the 80s.
Yeah.
It's like a lot of people are pointing out that there's a very 80s sort of pastel color scheme to this movie. And the trailers also also kind of push that image. And I look at that and say, honestly, Guardians 2 was a more 80s movie.
Yeah, Guardians 2.
Guardians 2 had the battle arcade.
Yeah, Guardians 2 had a video arcade.
How much more 80s can you get? It had a giant CGI Pac-Man that Pixels wished it had.
Yeah. Guardians 2 was way more 80s. Visually, this did take a lot of cues from the 80s, though. For the colors, the brightness, and all of that. And it's so great to see a movie that is not ashamed to be bright and colorful. And that's why one of the reasons why I love the Guardians movies, and I really like this movie, too, for the junk planet scenes. It also helped to juxtapose how dire things are on Asgard when you get to Asgard and the colors are all muted again. It's like, oh, like Hela's presence is literally like making the gold less shiny.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you think about how shiny Asgard was in Thor 1 and 2, the gold leapt off the screen at you in Thor 2. Even when you've got Christopher Eccleston flying his Dark Elf ship through all the towers, it was still bright and shiny gold. And then you get this, and it's all muted because Hela is just turning the contrast down on the set, just showing up there, and like everything's getting sour and depressing now because I'm here. But yeah, visually everything was great. Okay, we got to talk about Hulk. We haven't talked about Hulk yet. He's the last one. We got to talk Hulk.
Hulk is
a fully realized character. Mm-hmm. He's not an aspect of Banner.
Right.
He's a fully realized character. He has conversations with people.
Yes. He's been the Hulk for like 2 years at this point, since the events of Age of Ultron.
Mm-hmm.
And he's really been comfortable just being the Hulk and being this this gladiatorial hero and sports star. And people are like giving, you know, are holding Hulk parades in the streets because he's so goddamn awesome at beating people up for their amusement.
Yeah, the Hulk is surprised, you know, because like when Banner when he reverts to Banner at one point in the film, he makes a comment. The Hulk makes a comment earlier that everyone on Earth hates him. They hate the Hulk,
mm-hmm.
and that's not too far from the truth because the Hulk's only smashed things. And yet here he's on the planet, and it freaks Banner out because everyone on the planet loves the Hulk because he smashed things.
Mm-hmm.
It almost causes Banner to freak out and have, you know, and Hulk out again. And there is some concern from Banner that because the Hulk was driving the car for 2 solid years. He felt like he'd lost himself, and he's not sure he can regain control if he turns into the Hulk a second time. So there's that concern in the back of his mind when we get, you know, Banner, you know, when Banner actually does come back, and we get, you know, because we get Thor interacting with the Hulk and Thor interacting with Banner, and it's two different relationship mm-hmm. styles. It really is.
Mm-hmm. This is definitely the best you'll see of the Hulk. Since we apparently still can't seem to get a solo Hulk movie. And
at this point, I really thought the Ed Norton Hulk was a great film. I seem to be like one of three people in the North American continent who feels that way. I think that the way Hulk is being portrayed now in the MCU, he's gonna work best if he's got someone there who's also superpowered he can play off of.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a scene, we briefly see him interacting with Valkyrie. It's like right after the fight when Thor's, you know, wakes up in Hulk's apartment. Hulk and Valkyrie go off to do sparring practice. You know, he's got a bit of interaction with her. Like, yeah, that works. Hulk needs someone else superpowered he can just hang out with, and you can, he can, now that he can, now that he can say things and talk about things and have one-liners. You know, I still don't think Hulk standalone movie, because Hulk standalone movie, you gotta be careful what story you're taking, because in the previous Hulk movies, Hulk has been the anti-villain. He's what everyone is trying to destroy, but, you know, if they just leave him alone, he'll never show up and be a problem for anyone. He only shows up when people try to destroy him. And that can't keep working through multiple films.
Right.
You know, and so you need to give the Hulk a villain, but, you know, the Hulk's villains are all people who are smarter than the Hulk, that have the Hulk's powers and are in better control of things. You know, better control of their mm-hmm. faculties. So you either present the Hulk, which a couple times in the comics we had a Hulk where it was the Hulk's body and Banner's mind.
Yeah.
Which is interesting for a little while, but it undercuts the Hulk is essentially a Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde story.
Right.
So having him as a secondary, as a co-star in a movie is, I think, the best use they've gotten out of the Hulk so far.
Yeah. I think my favorite Hulk story actually is Future Imperfect. Are you familiar with that one?
The name is familiar, but I don't know.
Well, of course, the villain of that story is Future Hulk. Big, bushy, white-bearded Future Hulk. The Hulk will either die a hero or live long enough to see himself become the villain. That's kind of the point of that story, and that it's a pretty natural extension, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
All the rest I have to say about the Hulk is that, yeah, we were talking about references to previous movies. Thor eventually decides in his fight with the Hulk to do the sun's going low, a big boy thing that he saw Black Widow do in Age of Ultron. And the Hulk's response to that was to ragdoll him like he did to Loki in the previous Avengers movie. And Loki's response to that was, yeah, that's how that feels like. Which, I'm so glad I finally have another superhero, so that's what that feels like, to reference, other than the one from Dark Knight Rises. So I'm grateful about that.
Yeah.
I tell you what, man, we're running a bit long, and I'm pretty much already at the point where I was going to cut myself off, saying, like, nah, I'm not gonna spoil the rest of this movie.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, heaven forfend, for those of you out there who wanted to see this movie and were really waiting for our recommendation to go see it. You've probably already seen it already. Yeah. So
if you haven't seen the movie yet, and you are waiting for our recommendation, first of all,
thank you. I don't know who you are, but I love you. Right. I love you. You are a wonderful person. And secondly, yeah, go see this movie. Seriously.
I'm just glad that it was able to beat its heated rival, Bad Moms Christmas.
I forgot that movie was coming out.
I meant to mention this at the beginning of the review, because I also have a musical number planned for Bad Moms Christmas. Okay, here we go. Bad Moms. What you gonna do? What you gonna do when they give birth to you? Bad Moms. And that's all I have. So, yeah. You keep on ragging rocking me, baby, and I think we're just gonna cut it there. So for Mr. Brendan Michelli, I am Jordan Hazelwood, and we shall catch you next time at the Nonstop Comic Shop, where we'll always have issues. But before I forget, now I've been fighting real hard, and I'm trying to win a match, but Jeff Goldblum makes it so tough and unfair. Now there's no time to explain, just fly through the devil's anus. Why did Stan the man cut off my hair? So Judge Dredd's not so vicious, but Loki's still seditious, and the sun got low and now Hulk is weak. And it's no accident, Korg's got a Kiwi accent, but he's so sorry that he stepped on me. Keep Ragnarokin' me, baby. Keep Ragnarokin' me, baby. Keep Ragnarokin' me, rockin' me, rockin'. I just realized, am I going to have to do this for every single movie review we do now?
Yes. You open that door. this is why I don't put any effort in.
I only bring it up now because, of course, our next episode is the Justice League movie review.
So. Oh, can I have an ulcer that day?
I have no idea what song I'm supposed to hitch that wagon to. Do you have any?
I think a funeral march might be a good one.
Yeah, I was actually just thinking about a funeral march. Funny you mentioned that. But you realize, of course, that those don't tend to have lyrics.
True.
Shit. Well, goodbye.
For more podcasts at least as nerdy as this one, go to geekaid.com. Geekaid. It's spelled like a sports drink, not like an adhesive bandage.